You're listening to Born in the Second Century After Dark. If you've been listening to the Brighten the Corners miniseries, you know that I've been presenting and answering arguments from fundamentalists or from very conservative Christian theologians for probably the first time on this show. Usually, I'm going against the mainstream paradigm of Christian origins, as opposed to the fundamentalist or apologist paradigm. So lately, as a result, I've had to really immerse myself in that world, more so than usual. And I've been listening to a lot more apologetics podcasts because I really want to experience the cutting edge of their arguments. But in the course of doing this, I thought I'd share the experience of actually listening to these shows and what they're like. And then we'll be right back on schedule with the Gospel of Luke. Now for this, I want to say two things. The recording quality of the apologetic shows is often not that great, but I myself refuse to put out a substandard audio product, so I didn't simulate how the apologetic shows actually sound orally. The second thing is the voice of the host. Now, usually on Christian apologetic shows, the host sounds like someone who's trying to aggressively sell you a timeshare, but I'm not trying to trigger anyone's fight or flight response here. So I went with something more subdued. And my purpose in doing this parody in general is to demonstrate that the apologists have truly constructed a world unto themselves when it comes to Christian origins. It's got a fascinating internal logic to it. And when you see it represented, you start to realize how arguments like Matthew wrote Matthew because its title says Matthew can actually make sense to some people, to the point where they can boldly and shamelessly argue from that perspective. So here it is.
You're listening to the Season of Reason Christian Apologetics podcast, presented by Resource Ministries, LLC.
Welcome to the Season of Reason. I'm your host, Dr. E., a former marine biologist at Stanford, who became convinced of the truth of Jesus Christ through the study of marine biology, and am now a fellow traveler in the Word with you. On this show, we look at scholarly arguments and evidence of the reliability of the Gospels and the New Testament. But first, I've been thinking quite a bit lately about something we can all relate to, something that is unquestionably, inescapably American. I'm referring, of course, to our great national pastime, football. Or so it had been. That's right, America. Before we were devastated by the COVID-19 lockdowns, each state had its own professional football team that played every week. Imagine a perfect, cloudless day. The sun is warm and welcoming. And on the horizon, they appear like knights of yore, armed with projectiles of pigskin. Their name, the Baltimore Ravens. Their purpose, to make you, dear America, revel in the joys of sport and sunshine, if only for an afternoon. Now ask yourself this. What if the Baltimore Ravens could play again, right now, but with you as their owner and head coach? What if they could compete electronically with football teams from Pennsylvania or Virginia? Pay a visit to the Season of Reason Fantasy Football Facebook group, and football will live again. This is an organic effort that was set up by fans and listeners of this podcast. It's free, and it's great fun. While you're there, be sure to check out the Season of Reason merchandise page. This month, there's a sale on a fantastic book by Christian nuclear physicist Dr. Simone Martin. It's called Zapped by the Light: How the Study of Electrons Led Me to the Truth of the Gospel. Today, we have one of our best guests on the Season of Reason to date. When I was a child, growing up in rural Kentucky, I had the best friend a boy could hope for. My dear old dog, Honey. Oh, the adventures we had. From Knob Creek to Hodgenville we roamed, carefree and courageous, irresponsible, and completely inseparable. It was, for a little boy, the perfect existence. So let me ask you, America, how many of your children can say the same? How many of this nation's youth are truly happy, truly carefree? We both know the answer, don't we? None. America's children live a terrifying, godless, meaningless, faithless existence in a fallen world. There is no hope, no happiness. That changes, right here, right now. Because our guest today, Dr. Walter Pupp, has written a book called Christian Apologetics for 18 to 24-month-olds, a toddler's essential guide to witnessing the word. Dr. Pupp was formerly a federal prosecutor for 8 years before he was saved, and he went on to receive a doctorate in Bible truth from the Kent Hovind Christian Gift Shop, Shoe Hospital, and Seminary in Escambia County, Florida. You may already know Dr. Pupp as author of the book I Rest My Case, A Prosecutor Puts Atheism on Trial. Now he's written The Toddler's Guide to Apologetics, and we welcome him now, Dr. Walter Pupp. How have you been, Doctor?
It's good. Great to be here. Thank you for the intro.
Yes, Dr. Pupp, you've written an outstanding book here, but some of our listeners might be wondering, why teach Christian apologetics to someone who's only 24 months old?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've looked at the statistics of the percentage of people who practice Christianity in the U.S., and we used to have something in this country called 15, 18, 80, 22.
Uh-huh.
And what that means is, it used to be that even if a child was raised in the Christian faith, if that child reached age 15 and they hadn't read the Bible at least 18 times, they then had an 80% chance of abandoning their faith at age 20, with only a 2% chance that they would come back to the fold.
Hmm.
That's because they'd be going off to college and would get exposed to all the university professors, who were usually all Christ mythers. And so it used to be that you had to really instill Christianity in them prior to them reaching age 15. But now, things have accelerated so much that now we have something that looks more like 10, 12, 50, 18, 2. So they're at risk of losing their faith at a much younger age. And that means you got to teach them while they're still young.
Now, sorry to interrupt, Doctor, but why do you think that is? What's changed in recent years that has caused this acceleration of children losing their faith?
Yes, great question. It's the big glowing rectangle at the end of your arm. Cell phone. And every kid has one. And honestly, we as parents, we don't know what they're doing on their phones or on their tablets. You know, they could be playing Bart's Nightmare for the Super.
Indeed.
And that'd be fine. But they could also be surfing a Christ Mither app. So they're becoming exposed to this stuff at a very early age, questioning Christianity at a younger stage of life. And I wrote this book to make it clear that we, as parents, really need to do a better job of teaching these values to our little sons and daughters, to our toddlers, in fact. Like me, I mean, you know me, I'm evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how I approach the Gospels, right? So I'll have my 3-year-old daughter, you know, she's homeschooled anyway, so I'll do flashcards with her, you know, Roman crucifixion methods. And these are pictures and slides of actual Roman crucifixion methods, you know, from archaeology.
Yes.
And I talked to her about things like how crucifixion victims actually died. It's not from the hanging. It's from the asphyxiation. Because your wrists and ankles would be nailed to the support beam and your lungs are locked in that inhale position. So to take a breath, you have to painfully inch upward with your back scratching against the coarse wood of that cross. And you did that until you basically couldn't do it anymore. And your lungs filled up with fluid, and the pericardial sac became filled with blood and with clear fluid, just like it says in the Gospel of John, when they pierced Jesus' side with a spear. You know, and things like that, they show that what's reported in the Gospels is being reported faithfully. These kinds of things really happened.
Mm.
And this is just some of what I share with my 3-year-old, twice a day. And these are in flashcard format, and we include these in the book.
That's wonderful. Dr. Pupp, what we want to discuss today is something that's dear to many listeners' hearts, the historical reliability of the Gospels. Let's first start by explaining how you yourself came to understand that the Gospels are true, authentic history.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, as I lay out in my book, I Rest My Case, and I've talked about it many times in interviews, I was a federal prosecutor for 8 years. And at that time, I was not Christian. But federal prosecutors, what do? They make a case. And they look at the information available to make that case, and that trains you to really look at the data. And the rules and the standards of evidence for trying a case in federal court are the exact same rules that are used by scholars, even skeptical scholars, to evaluate the Gospels. There's absolutely no difference.
Yes.
That's why you find that so many lawyers, prosecutors, and police detectives are also biblical scholars, because there's a one-to-one match with how they evaluate evidence and how scholars evaluate the Gospels. But for me, when I was a prosecutor, I hated Christians. I mean, I put them in jail on purpose, you know, even when they were innocent. I went out of my way to write Xmas instead of Christmas in my work emails. I couldn't even bring myself to write the name of Christ. Didn't even want to even look at it. But one day, I opened up the Gospel of Mark, and I said to myself, let's see if I can poke some holes in this stupid thing. Now, because, you know, that's what busy atheists do. They all own a complete New Testament, and they occasionally pick it up and read it for no reason. And I read that day the account of Jesus calming the storm.
Yes.
You know, and I was making fun of it, you know, saying, how can this be true? But then I noticed one of the details in the account that Mark gives, which is that Jesus was asleep in the stern with his head on a cushion. And I thought to myself, that's pretty detailed, and that's surprising. Why would the author preserve a detail like this? And I knew it had to be true because I've been fishing. I mean, I love fishing. And I mean, you go out there in the fishing boat, sometimes you want to take a nap. Yeah, it's a hot day. And what do? You put your head on the cushion. So it occurred to me that whoever wrote this had to have been there, or he carefully interviewed someone who was there. And that kind of was the first chink in the armor for me. And from there, I read the Gospels in full. And I started to see all kinds of little details like that. Little incidental things. The kind of things that are important for a prosecutor to establish the facts of the case. And over time, it all started to add up. And the evidence was overwhelming. And so I like to say that I was saved by evidence. Even though it says we're supposed to be saved by faith, I think the Lord maybe made an exception in my case.
Well, that's really exceptional. And what you say about the cushion does make sense. I mean, if someone were to make up this account, then they would have said...
Yeah, they would have said, you know, Jesus flew up.
Yes.
And he grew to unfathomable size with rock music playing in the background, kind of like, you know, Megazord from Power Rangers.
Right.
Yeah, and he cried out, "Be gone, storm," you know, and he punches the storm into the abyss. And they wouldn't say he's sleeping. And they certainly wouldn't say his head was on a cushion. I mean, that's an incidental, maybe a meaningless detail you could think of it as.
Sure.
You know, but scholars, even skeptical scholars, have shown that in ancient history writing, the presence of these little discriminating details means that the account is true. Because ancient people thought differently than we did. Especially ancient Palestinian people, their brains were different. They didn't know how to make up details. Their brain was basically like my driveway, is what I like to tell people, because my driveway, you know, at home is a semicircle. Car drives in on the one side, and it can only come out the other. Same thing with ancient people in this region. The sense data hits them on the one end, and it comes out on the other side at their desk as a true historical report. And you could also look at Plutarch, Tacitus, Suetonius, Livy, Cicero, Ammianus Marcellinus, Pliny, Diodorus, same thing.
That's wonderful, Doctor. But perhaps our listeners would like to hear your evidence, your reasons that the Gospels are reliable. Because the culture is very much against this idea of the Gospels being true. Almost every television show, every YouTube video, every Netflix, every magazine, every movie, every character in all those movies is usually a Christ myther who hates Jesus and says that the Gospels aren't reliable. And they'll often use the arguments employed by Bart Ehrman and others. So I was hoping you could speak to that and give us some of your reasons why the Gospels ought to be taken seriously.
Yes, great question. I just want to say one quick thing about Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman is the single biggest threat to Christianity since the Roman Emperor Diocletian, who ruled from 284 to 305 AD. And I do not say that lightly.
Indeed.
But you're right. I mean, his views and the views of the Christ mythers, they absolutely dominate the culture. Every 10-year-old is texting his friends at night, you know, girls in his class at school, and they're talking about Bart Ehrman. They're talking about books like Jesus Before the Gospels. So we want to hit back, but we haven't done a great job with Christian apologetics. We suck. We've done a crappy job. And it begins at home with the parents. And it begins with you who are listening at home, you know, spending some time in the Word, dialoguing with your pastor, doing that homework.
Indeed. And what about your reasons?
Absolutely. First reason is the gospel authors never say that they're lying.
Hmm.
And that's important. My son, I tell him all the time, son, you're lying. And he admits it. Yeah, Dad, I'm lying. And he gets punished. But the gospel authors don't do that. And that's important. Because ancient authors oftentimes will tell you when they're lying. Like, you look at Plutarch, Tacitus, Suetonius, Livy, Cicero, Ammianus Marcellinus, Pliny, Diodorus, Thucydides. I mean, Thucydides makes things up. And he tells you, I'm making it up. I'm making up this speech. I wasn't there. I'm making up what I thought they may have said. And scholars, even skeptical scholars, will tell you, he's not lying about the historical events that happened. He's just lying about the speech. And they believe Thucydides on the historical events. Now, if Thucydides says that he's lying about some things, and the gospel authors never even say that they're lying, then how much more should we believe the gospel authors than we believe Thucydides? Because, again, ancient authors were contractually obligated to state when they were making things up. Their brains, again, were much different than ours. We always got to keep that in mind. You know, they're not... Tacitus wouldn't have understood how to download music or to stream music, okay? Tacitus did not have access to Napster. If you talk to Tacitus about Napster, he'd say, what's that? So ancient people were much different from us. And one difference is when they were lying, they admitted it beforehand.
Splendid. What about reason number two, Doctor? Let's call it our second R.
Reason number two is that the authors of the Gospels wrote in the history genre. Specifically, they wrote ancient biography, what's called bios. And if you chose to write in that genre in ancient Rome, you were not allowed to make any part of it up. If you were writing a bios and you made something up, you would get kicked out of ancient Rome if you did that. I mean, if you wanted to make something up, there were other genres of writing that you would have had to formally choose to write in. I mean, you could look at things like Plutarch, Tacitus, Suetonius, Livy, Cicero, Ammianus Marcellinus, Pliny, Diodorus. You see the same thing. Ancient authors were required to officially select a specific genre to write in, and these genres had rigid rules that were set in stone. You would catch on fire if you violated any of these rules. They were so strict. And the fact that these gospel authors wrote in the history genre, you don't even have to investigate anything beyond that, because the fact that they wrote in this universally defined genre of history is in and of itself a proof that they were telling the truth and getting it right.
Wonderful. Reason number three, our third R. I understand this one is about the words of Jesus.
Yes, the words of Jesus were faithfully preserved, and we know that because these were the records of sermons. When you read the Sermon on the Mount, you're not necessarily reading a sermon that Jesus preached on like one single day and in one single place. Jesus preached the same things probably thousands of times in thousands of places over and over again, saying similar words, same message. You know, he's preaching the gospel, repent. And not only was he preaching it, but also the disciples who sat under his teaching. After his death, they preached the same things day in and day out, because that's what modern pastors do in their preaching. They prepare a sermon and they preach the sermon again and again. So what English-speaking, suburban American megachurch pastors do in the 21st century is exactly what Palestinian charismatic prophets did in the first century.
Well, Doctor, you've done a fantastic job laying out the evidence for why Christians should consider the Bible to be reliable. And not just Christians, non-believers as well, even atheists. But could we apply this evidence method to a specific part of the Gospels, one that's been heavily scrutinized in the culture, which is the resurrection of Jesus? Because that's quite a big one. And it seems to me, Doctor, that we can't afford to let our defenses waver when it comes to the Lord's resurrection and the accounts about it that are preserved in the Gospels. What would you say to someone like a Bart Ehrman or a Da Vinci Code, for example, who doubts the accounts of the resurrection that are given in the Gospels?
Show me the body.
Right, of course.
Show me the body. Right? Jerry Maguire? Because it's an empty tomb. But I think you've touched on something here, because this is where the enemy is choosing to attack nowadays, the gospel account of the resurrection. The first thing I would say is that scholars, even skeptical scholars, agree that something happened. You could take these accounts to someone like Gerd Ludemann. He'd tell you the same thing. He says in his book about the resurrection accounts that, quote, there's no doubt that the resurrection narratives in the Gospels are about Jesus, end quote. And that's important. I mean, even atheists agree that these narratives are talking about something. We disagree with atheists on everything, and we gainsay every single thing that they say, and we write entire books about how they have faulty judgment on everything under the sun. But when they agree with us, that's apparently all water under the bridge. In fact, their agreement on these topics is more important for some reason than a Christian's agreement would be. And what's important to remember is that something happened that had to make Matthew and Mark, Luke and John want to write their accounts. If nothing happened, there'd be no accounts. If something happened, and it did, then that's why we have the accounts.
Indeed. Dr. Poop, what would you say to those who doubt the resurrection account? Because it appears to differ in each of the four Gospels.
Well, it doesn't really differ, and I'll tell you why. Because as a prosecutor, I had to put witnesses on the stand, and their accounts may differ in the wording, but they're talking about the same thing, so the underlying thing actually happened. And this is where memory comes into play, and you can look at a lot of the scholarship on memory that's been conducted, and what scholars on memory report is that not everyone remembers things the same way.
So you're saying, Doctor, that the strength of these accounts is in the fact that they differ from one another?
Yes, in fact, that is the primary reason that these accounts are true, because they differ.
So, if the accounts are true because they differ, then what about the things they agree on? Are the things they agree on not true?
No. The fact that they agree on some things is also proof that they're true. See, for example, they all agree that there was no body in the tomb. So, that's multiple attestation from multiple sources. So, we have a high degree of confidence that the tomb was empty.
That's wonderful, Doctor, but I'm still needing a bit of clarity on something you said. You said the accounts are true based on what they agree about, but not on what they disagree about.
Oh, no. They're true because they agree on some things, and they're true because they disagree on some things.
Ah.
If they 100% agreed, they would be false. If they 100% disagreed, they would also be false. But the fact that they 50% agree and they 50% disagree, mathematically, they are therefore 100% true.
Oh, I see.
And you could look at a book by Karl Popper, Conjectures and Refutations, that talks about that. But the most important proof that the resurrection account and the empty tomb is true and actually happened is because women are reported as being the eyewitnesses.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to remember that women in the ancient world, and in ancient Judaism in particular, they were not considered to be reliable witnesses to anything.
Indeed.
I mean, in fact, if you were in ancient Rome right now, and a woman told you that your house was on fire, you wouldn't even believe it. That's how little woman's testimony was valued. Like me, if my wife says, "Honey, I set the kitchen on fire," I'm not going to doubt her testimony, you know, because we've come a long way. We believe women now, mostly, in some cases. But if a woman even reported a crime, it wasn't even investigated in ancient Rome.
Mm.
And women were not admissible as court witnesses. Like, I was a federal prosecutor. I interviewed women every day. That wouldn't have been possible if I was a federal prosecutor in ancient Rome. They weren't allowed to testify. And looking at a cave and then going to tell your friends about it is the exact same thing as officially testifying in a court. You know, and it's not like the reason that the women were the first to visit the tomb was because, like, you know, that was like the only conceivable plot element that was allowed by the logic of the story, because it says they were coming to anoint the body, thus giving them an actual reason to be there. Whereas the disciples and the men around Jesus wouldn't have had, by the logic of the story, an actual reason to be poking around the tomb. And it would have made the story highly suspicious if they were portrayed as doing that. It's that these events really happened, and the gospel authors were forced to write what actually occurred. They, you know, Mark probably wished that men witnessed the empty tomb first. I mean, it would have made his life a heck of a lot easier.
Yes.
But the truth is that women did. So he's forced to write about it. And he and the other gospel authors are absolutely forced to write actually what happened at the tomb without changing any detail in any way. And that's the biggest proof that we have that these accounts are real.
Indeed, Doctor. And you spoke about memory. How does memory tie into the truth of the resurrection and the empty tomb?
Yes, great question. Now, the resurrection accounts are highly detailed, which that in and itself is proof of how memorable these events were to those who were writing. Because when you remember something really well, you remember little details, especially with major events in your life. And this one here is the majorest of them all. You know, the resurrection of our Lord. Doesn't get any more majorist than that. Now, for me, I can't remember what I had for dinner last week, for example. But I can remember, with distinct clarity, a conversation that I had with my wife before we got married, where we agreed that in the event we were ever separated or divorced, that she wouldn't go after my fishing equipment. And whether she or her attorney is now choosing to forget that, I still remember.
So you say that these key details would have stuck in the disciples' memory over many years.
Exactly. They would have remembered them just as well as someone remembers 9/11, for example, and what they were doing on that day. I mean, I definitely...
Or the death of FDR. I distinctly remember where I was when I first heard the news.
How old are you, sir?
Dr. Pup, even though these are eyewitness reports that were burned into the memory of the disciples, they do have some differences in them when you look at the four Gospels side by side. So perhaps you can paint a picture for us from your research, if you would, on what actually might have happened on that glorious day.
Yes, great question. These are exactly the kind of differences that we would expect with eyewitness testimony. You expect some details to differ. You know, if no details differed, and if Matthew, Mark, Luke, John were all saying the same thing, then we'd have reason to worry. But if you've interviewed witnesses, if you've dealt with eyewitness testimony, then it becomes fairly easy to sift through the gospel accounts and reconstruct an accurate picture of what happened. A very simple, elegant picture.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, four women visited the tomb. Mark says it was three women and that they were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. Luke also says it was three women, and he says that they were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Joanna. Matthew says it was two women, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. So clearly what happened is that Mark interviewed Mary Magdalene, who forgot that Joanna had been there, and Luke interviewed Mary, the mother of James, who forgot that Salome had been there. And so when Matthew interviewed the two women, they both forgot that there had been two women there besides them. And that's how these gospels were put together. They're eyewitness interviews. Mark and Matthew and Luke interviewed these folks, you know, with their wax tablet and, their Hellenistic talk boy at the ready.
Yes.
And a common phenomenon in oral interviews is that they usually differ in very basic details. You know, even though I just said that these events were imprinted on their mind, just like the memory of 9/11 is imprinted on ours, and therefore they wouldn't have forgotten anything. So when Mark interviews Mary Magdalene, she forgot that Joanna had been there. But when Matthew interviewed her, she still forgot that Joanna had been there. But on the day that Matthew was interviewing her, she also happened to forget that day that Salome had been there. And this is what we'd expect. I mean, ask any police detective. He'll tell you the same thing. And the gospel authors did interview every eyewitness they could get their hands on. But when it was time to actually write the gospels, they only usually chose to preserve one small part of those accounts. And this is exactly what we see in ancient history writing. The authors will often write about events, but what they'll do is they often only tend to follow one imperfect witness's recollection of those events. Like Mark knew, of course, that he wasn't giving the full story of what had happened at the tomb, but number one, he was following his source, which was his witness interview. And yes, secondly, every Christian knew the story of what went down at the tomb, so Mark didn't need to do a blow-by-blow. You know, he's reciting an account that's well-known, and the audience would have been able to fill in the gaps and the details that were missing. Now, Mark does go into extreme detail about some things, like he says that the angel was sitting at the right. He says that the stone was rolled away because it was very large. He says both that it's very early and that the sun had just risen, but don't let that kind of thing distract you. He's not trying to give a voluminous record, trust me on that. So now, the gospel accounts appear also to disagree on how many angels the women saw at the tomb.
Mm.
Some of the gospels say that they saw one, others say they saw two, or others that only one of them saw two. You know, same thing with the guards at the tomb. Some of the gospels mention guards, others don't. The thing to remember here is that ancient people were usually only capable of observing one thing at a time. They're kind of like those telepathic space dogs, the Tynes, from the Werner Vinge science fiction novels.
Yes.
So often what they would do is that when they set out in a group to go somewhere in ancient times, you know, each of them would be responsible for observing only one thing that they encountered. And so we see that in the Gospels. Before these women went to the tomb, each of them was likely put in charge of observing a different thing. So, for example, when they got to the tomb, Mary Magdalene was only responsible for observing one angel. Now, any other angel that happened to be there, she didn't see. It fell outside of her purview.
Mm.
Mary, the mother of James, was also responsible for viewing and observing one angel, but not the same one as Mary Magdalene was. So the Gospels that say that they only saw one angel are basing that off of only one testimony of only one of the women. Now, in some Gospels, it says that the guards were there. Others don't mention the guards. It doesn't mean that the guards weren't there. It's just that only one of the women was assigned to observe the guards. And the Gospels who say that there were guards, those were the ones whose authors happened to have interviewed the one specific woman who was in charge of seeing the guards. But here's how we can reconstruct the other events that happened at the tomb, and what I think happened. In Mark's gospel, the angel says, "He is risen." But I think that Mary Magdalene didn't stay to hear that part. She ran off before the angel actually started speaking. And just like it says in John, she runs off to Peter and tells him that the Lord's body was stolen from the tomb. Then the other women who were at the tomb actually stay there and they listen to the angel's speech where he tells them he is risen. And when they hear that, they run off. First, they're afraid and tell no one, like it says in Mark. But then they become unafraid and tell someone, like it says in Matthew. See, Matthew and Mark are just reporting different events that happen on the same day. Mark's account does not exclude Matthew's account. And so the women become unafraid and they tell someone, which is the disciples, minus Peter and John, who had already run off to the tomb earlier when Mary Magdalene told them that the body was stolen, like it says in John's gospel. But then at some point they come back and Jesus appears to them on the mountain. No, like it says in Matthew's gospel. But then they, at some point, they forget that experience, probably because of the high level of stress they were under at this time.
Indeed.
And then later, Jesus appears to them in the house and eats a fish, like it says in Luke's gospel. So it's really simple. And these accounts are actually in close harmony with one another. But I have to say to your audience, don't take it from me. Don't take my word for it. Don't even take Dr. E's word for it. Do your own homework. Do your own research. And one of the ways you could do that is by picking up my books and other research materials that I have available at the Wayside Ministries website.
That's superb, Dr. Pup, and I know that our audience will very much appreciate the tools that you've made available on your website. Give me an amen.
Amen.
No, I thank you for that, Dr. Pup, but on this podcast we have a special text line. And whenever I say, give me an amen, any listener who chooses to do so can text amen to 8402.
Oh, I see. I need something like that for my show.
Indeed. Lastly, I want to ask you something that I ask all the guests on the Season of Reason. Why is the Bible so harshly criticized in the culture? You can't escape from it. You see it everywhere, from the sanctimonious late-night hosts to the blue check marks on Twitter. It seems that it's open season on the Bible and on Christianity, and has been for some time. Now, why?
Yes, great question. People criticize the Bible because they hate Christians. That's number one. But more importantly, I think people are willful. They want to live the way that they want to live. And I was like that before I accepted Christ as my forgiver and leader on November 5th, 2015. I lived an immoral, drunken, profane existence. And that's what these critics of Christianity want to do. And it's only possible to live like that if you're not Christian. And they don't want to become Christian, so they don't listen to the evidence. They don't want to hear the testimony. But having said that, I love them, and I pray for them every single day.
Well said, Doctor. I pray that you'll come back again. We just love our conversations with you, and we just honor the gift of God in you. And we thank our guest, Dr. Walter Poop, for joining us. Thank you for the time today.
Love you, and love your listeners.
We've proved today to a certainty that the Gospels are reliable. Thank you for tuning in today. I pray that you feel equipped. Don't give up hope. God's promises are as potent as they've ever been. We'll meet you back here next time, when we'll speak to Dr. Stephen Hibbs, an ex-lion tamer who will describe how his profession led him to Christ through a new understanding of Paul's letter to the Ephesians.
You're listening to the Season of Reason Christian Apologetics podcast, presented by Resource Ministries, LLC.